So we are continuing on in Isaiah. Now, you know, Isaiah, they found scrolls amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls that contained the book of Isaiah. 24 feet of scroll that had the book of Isaiah. It was the oldest book of all the ones they found in that Dead Sea Scrolls. And of course, it's Isaiah prophesying of what is to become of the Israelites. He's telling them that the Babylonians are about to come and kick hiney. And the Israelites, you know, they're off doing their own thing. So, you know, the first few chapters of Isaiah, he's warning them. So let's take a look. It kind of picks up right in the end of chapter 2. You know, it wasn't God or Isaiah that put these paragraphs and chapters together. That was man that did that. So sometimes there's some overlap there. But it starts out in verse 1, it says, "For behold," and that "for behold" relates back to those last few verses in chapter 2. Verse 22 says, "Sever yourself from such a man whose breath is in his nostrils, for what of account is he? For behold, the Lord of hosts, takes away from Jerusalem and from Judah the stock and the store, the whole supply of bread and the whole supply of water." So Isaiah is saying, look, you guys, it's the Lord of hosts, not just the Lord of hosts. He says, I want you to understand, this is the Lord that is in control of the hosts of angels, the powerful, mighty God. It's not just the Lord, it's the Lord of hosts. And Isaiah does that several times throughout his book. He refers to the Lord as the Lord of hosts because he wants people to understand that this is a powerful judging God that is about to do something. So pay attention. He says, "The Lord of hosts takes away from Jerusalem and from Judah the stock and the store." A lot of translations say the stay and the staff. And those are essentially the same words, but it's the masculine and the feminine version of those. Isaiah is saying he's taken it all. He's taking what you got in stock, and he's taking what you got on the shelves. He's taking it all. He's taking the whole supply of bread and the whole supply of water. Now, we need bread and water. We need stock and supply. And if we don't have that, we're in a bad way. And Isaiah is saying to Israel, God is about to take things from you because you're not paying attention. God is about to take the things that you need to get your attention. How many times have you been there where you're in that valley and there's no place to turn but to God? He had to get you to that place in order for you to say, oh yeah, what about God? You know, we try everything on our own and then we finally turn to Him. When if we'd have turned to Him 3 or 4 weeks back, it'd have been much smoother sailing at that point. He's saying, pay attention, because the powerful God of hosts is about to take stuff. He's going to take the mighty man and the man of war, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder. He's taken away all the leadership. He's taken what you need physically. He's taken what you need in terms of leadership. You're going to be wandering. You're going to have no one to guide you, no one to make decisions and help to rule over you, to provide laws and rules. And it's going to be chaotic. It's going to be anarchy. It's going to be lawless. He's taking the captain of 50. He's taking all the people in the armies, even the captains who could control 50 men. He's taken them away. The honorable man, the counselor, the skillful artisan, and the expert enchanter. He's taking all of that, the stock and the supply, to where you're only going to have him to depend on. And I will give you children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. Now, this is sort of figuratively. He's not talking about putting a 12-year-old into leadership. He's talking about inexperienced people. All the people that have wisdom, they're gone. You're going to have just these inexperienced neophytes trying to rule you, trying to make decisions. And the people will be oppressed, everyone by another, and everyone by his neighbor. The child will be insolent toward the elder, and the base toward the honorable. When you take away the good leadership, and you put someone who doesn't understand power into a position of ruling, that power can very, very easily corrupt. I remember years ago, when I was still in college, I learned about the concept of a Delphi study. Anybody ever heard of a Delphi study? What they do is they take a list of questions, and this particular list that I was reading about was about the Third World War. They give it out to all the experts. The experts answer those questions. They gather those answer sheets in, and then they give those answer sheets to all the experts. So all the experts see what the other experts are saying, and then they ask them to answer the questions a second time after seeing what every other expert has weighed in on. And from that, you get this may perhaps better thought through result. And one of the things they came up with in this was that the Third World War is likely to be in the Middle East, primarily because they'll get nuclear weapons, and without having the practice of controlling that power, they'll use it unwisely. And you could very easily see how that can happen. We see that a lot of times even in our own country, in small communities where people don't necessarily have a political background, they get into a position of leadership, and they misuse it. And then we see those who are, say, in Washington, who have practiced that power, and they understand how that power can be used, and they use it for their own gain. And so people become oppressed. We see that in this country all over. The child will be insolent toward the elder. Huh. Well, we see that, don't we? Little juvenile delinquents sassing mom and dad, you know, that kind of stuff going on all around the place. And the base toward the honorable. The dishonest people are being, they're not respecting the honorable people. Now, that's happening here in this country. We're seeing those things, that people are being oppressed, everyone by another, everyone by his neighbor, children insolent toward their elders, base toward the honorable. And when you take away the leadership, when you take away the people that God has placed in positions of power to rule and to judge, that's what you get. And we're facing that in this country. We have people in, I go back and forth with myself whether the pulpit is a place for politics, but I think it is a place for leadership and wisdom. So I'm just going to throw this out, and you take it for what you will. We have people in power, in leadership in this country, who aren't willing to do the right thing. We all know, you look at the national debt, that cannot continue. There's no way. There's just no physical way that our national debt can continue the way it is. In your home, when spending exceeds the income, you have two options. Cut spending, get more income, take another job, okay? So in Washington, someone is going to have the guts to cut spending and raise taxes. That's the only way we're ever going to get out of this. But those people in power, and here's where I start getting political, those people in power are in it for the long run. They're not in it for the short term like it was designed. This country was set up to have short-term people in those places of representative and senator leadership. Short terms, not long terms, not careers. And they don't want to lose their career. They want to get reelected. And if they cut taxes or cut spending and raise taxes, all those wonderful programs that we now have a right to have, We are now not just lucky to have welfare. I have a right to be on welfare, and I don't begrudge anyone who needs that service. That's why it's there. Okay, I'm getting political. Somebody has to step up. If this country is going to get out from underneath this debt, someone's going to have to step up. That's not how this country was designed. You understand that this country was planned by God. The pilgrims came here for a reason. And a lot of people think it was for religious freedom. They already had that. They had left England 7 years before they came here and gone to Holland and had religious freedom. Do you know why they came here? I tell you, if you want to read a good book, read The Light and the Glory. It's by Peter Marshall. It's about God's plan for America. And let me just tell you what William Bradford, who was the leader of the pilgrims, here's why he said they came to this country. He said, number one, their life was so hard that almost no others were coming from England to join them, even after the king's edict of 1618, which decreed that all Puritans not willing to conform to ecclesiastical authority had to leave the country. The king had said, you will participate in the Church of England or you'll get out. And they had, the pilgrims had gone to Holland, and the work there, the in order to make a living, people were working so hard that nobody wanted to come from England to Holland. So the first one was that their life was getting so miserable in terms of their work that nobody would come and join them. The second was that their life was aging them prematurely because they were working so hard, and was so debilitating that should the time come when they would have to move again, they might not be physically able to do it. The third reason, and pay attention, their children were being worn down and drawn away into the lures of the world. That what was happening in the culture of Netherlands was affecting the pilgrims' children. They said, we need to get out of here. And fourth, they had cherished a great hope and inward zeal of playing a part, if only as a stepping stone for others, in carrying forth the light of Christ to the new world. They came as missionaries. They had their religious freedom. They left England and went to Holland 7 years in 1613. They came here in 1620, not for religious freedom, but because the world was affecting their children, where they, their culture they were in was working them too hard, and they wanted to be bring the light of glory to the new world. That's why they came here. And that's why this country, you read a book like this, The Light and the Glory by Peter Marshall, and you find out just how involved God was in the planning of this country. And you compare that to what's happening with the Israelites and how Isaiah is talking about people being oppressed, people having, you know, an infantile leadership, people that are in control, you know, oppressing others. And you begin to see a lot of parallels. And as we read through Isaiah in the coming weeks and study, consider that. Make that comparison in your own mind. You'll see those parallels without having to point them out. Well, verse 6, when a man takes hold of his brother in the house of his father, saying, you have clothing, you be our leader, and let those ruins be under your power. In that day, he will protest, saying, I can't cure your ills, for in my house is neither food nor clothing. Do not make me a ruler of the people. In these days, if you had stuff, particularly clothing, you were rich. I mean, if you had clothing, cloaks, you know, robes, garments, you were considered to be pretty well off. So here Isaiah is saying, all those leaders are gone, and people are going to turn to somebody who has stuff. Say, well, you must be rich. Why don't you take care of it? You be the person in power. You be the person that tells us what to do. And that guy's saying, I can't cure your ills. You have to be responsible for yourself. Self-reliance, self-responsibility, self-government is what this country was founded on. You can't have a democracy if people won't govern themselves as individuals. And we have given up personal responsibility. You know, you can't just make decisions for yourself anymore. Got to have a bike helmet, it's a law. You got to have a seatbelt, it's a law. You can't text while you're driving, it's a law. Well, if you're any kind of intelligence, you ought to be able to see. Texting, that ain't very smart. Riding a bike, you ought to wear a helmet. Safety in a car, wear a seatbelt. Be responsible for yourself without having to have all these laws. And every law that comes down affects us economically. It affects us physically. It affects us in a myriad of ways. I heard a talk one time that was introducing how laws affect us economically. And the example he used was butchers. You could put a pound of meat on that scale and maybe put your finger on that scale to where you really only put 15 ounces instead of 16 ounces. But it says a pound, you get charged for a pound. Butcher makes a little extra, you get charged a little extra. So now you have a law that says you have to have that scale adjusted every so often and regimented and regulated to make sure you have a pound for a pound or a gallon for a gallon. That just causes extra money. Now you have this whole regulatory system that you got to pay for, you know, and it just compounds from there. If we could be responsible and say a pound is a pound, then we wouldn't have to have all these extra regulatory kinds of things. We have to be responsible for ourselves before, as a nation, we can be responsible for all the other things that, we think that we can do. I can't cure your ills. I'm not your doctor. You need to be responsible for yourself. Verse 8, for Jerusalem stumbled and Judah is fallen. This is the place that God set up as an example for the rest of the world. Judah was his people, but they've stumbled. They're in ruins because their tongue and their doings are against the Lord. They can't be counted upon anymore. They've provoked the eyes of his glory. The look of their countenances witnesses against them, and they declare their sins as Sodom. They do not hide it. Woe to their soul, for they have brought evil upon themselves. Anytime you see woe, pay attention. And there's a lot of woes that come out in Isaiah. So, but always look at those woes. Here's woe to their soul because they're declaring their sin just like the people in Sodom did. They're not trying to hide it. Remember in Sodom, the two angels came to visit Lot, and all the people stood outside the door saying, hey, send those two guys out so we may know them. Well, to know them in the biblical sense is to have sex with them. Send them out here. There's new blood in town. You know, we have new inventory if you want. But they didn't hide it. It was rampant. And we have people, you know, coming out of the closet now. And I mean, it used to be that you didn't see people smoking in public, particularly not women. But Hollywood changed all that. You know, it became glamorous to have a cigarette. You know, it used to be just the wanton women who smoked in public. Now, thanks to Hollywood, maybe it's not Hollywood's fault, but Hollywood impacted it. It's just open. We have sin. People are proud of their sin. They're proud to say, I do this, I do that. You know, there's no shame in sin, it seems. And woe to them. Woe to their soul. For they're going to reap what they sow. They're going to bring evil punishments upon themselves. Say to the righteous that it shall be well with them, for they shall eat the fruit of their doings. So the righteousness, there's still hope for the righteousness. Woe to the wicked, it shall be ill with him, for the reward of his hand shall be given him. And it's nice to know that amongst all of this that's going on, there is still righteous people. Remember when Elisha was in the cave and he was hiding from the king, and he told God, he says, they've killed all the prophets, I'm the last one left. And God said, I have reserved for myself 7,000. Even in that era, when Elisha thought that all the people were gone, there were still 7,000 that God had reserved for himself. He's reserving righteous people all the time. Verse 12, as for my people, and he still calls them my people. I love that. After all he's saying that they've done wrong, he's still calling them my people. He still has their future in his will. They're still his people. As for my people, children are their oppressors and women rule over them. O my people, those who lead cause you to err and destroy the way of your paths. You know, the people who's the people that lead today? You know, we got rock stars and movie stars on TV telling us that we should vote this way and eat this food and drink this drink. And, you know, thus we're getting our leadership from the wrong places today. We need to be aware of who it is that we're following. Verse 13, the Lord stands up to plead and stands to judge the people, his people. The Lord will enter into judgment with the elders of his people and his princes. For you have eaten up the vineyard. The plunder of the poor is in your house. I think about, you know, the Lord stands up to plead. I think about some of these TV shows and movies that have court scenes, and the attorney stands up, Your Honor, I object. You know, and they stand up. They don't just, you know, raise their hand or whatever. They get up and they're adamant about their feelings about a certain thing. And here's the judge, the Lord, pleading for us, standing up to say, wait, stop, hang on. But he also stands to judge. He's not only our advocate, he is our judge. He's going to make decisions about where we are in our lives and the things that are happening. He has a plan. He has a will Roy and I were talking this morning about will and trying to find God's will in our lives. Wouldn't it be easy if you just put it up on the screen? Here's what I want you to do. But no, we got to live by faith. We got to live by faith. We have a little sticker on our refrigerator. It says, God's will, exactly what I would do if I had all the facts. Because see, God's got all the facts. God knows what's happening tomorrow. He knows what happened yesterday. He knows what's happening right now. He's got the facts. He knows the plan. We have to do it by faith. We have to turn to Him and say, God, show me. We have to step out and test that faith. And oftentimes, we're reluctant to take that step. We think our faith is there. We certainly profess it. We talk about it. We mouth it. But until we actually step out and test it, we don't know just how strong it is. And I guarantee you that every time you step out and God is there with you and you make that step, your faith will grow. Your faith isn't going to grow if you're not stepping out. When I learned to ski, Leah was a college ski team skier. And so when I met her, I had to learn to ski. And she told me, if you're not falling, you're not challenging yourself. You're not learning anything. If all you do is go down the slopes, you can have a good time, but you're not progressing. You're not growing. You're not getting stronger in your skills. It's the same in our faith. If all we do is come to church on Sunday and Bible study on Wednesday night, we'll be all right. We still have Jesus in our heart. But until we step out and say, God, where would you have me go? And let Him direct our path and test that faith, we're not going to grow. We won't get closer. We won't find the things God wants for us until we step out and test that faith. And I think that's what he's talking about here, that He's going to judge us. He's going to plead for us and judge us and enter into judgment with the elders of His people. For you have eaten up the vineyard. The vineyard is His people. And we see that in chapter 5. He talks about the vineyard being His people. If you can see chapter 5 without having to turn the page, it's verse 7. He says, the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. So you've eaten up the vineyard. The plunder of the poor is in your house. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the faces of the poor, says the Lord God of hosts. There's that Lord God of hosts again. You're grinding these people. You know, you ever sharpen an axe on a grinding wheel? You get that grinding wheel spinning and you put that axe blade on there and you get all them sparks and it heats up and it gets hot and it grinds it down. And you can grind it flat. You can grind it right down to nothing. Grinding is painful. If you put your hand on that grinding wheel, it's just going to eat the skin right off you. And here he's saying, all these people that are oppressing my people, you're grinding their face. You're grinding them to nothing. You know, what do you mean by that? You're crushing them. And he's going on to say, because the daughter of Zion are haughty and walk with outstretched necks and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go, making a jingling with their feet, therefore, the Lord will strike with a scab, the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion, and the Lord will uncover their secret parts. You know, the women are strutting their stuff. They got all their fancy jewelry and their hair all done, and their necks are outstretched and bracelets and jingling. And God's saying, you know, you're haughty. You're walking with mincing steps, and He's going to strike them with a scab. The Lord will strike with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion. The crown of the head is the hair. And these daughters of Zion would spend hours brushing their hair and primping themselves to go out in public. And God said, you know, that's not what I'm asking you to do. And I'm going to take that hair away. I'm going to make you bald. That scab, the crown of the head is a scab, means being bald. And how often today do we see women running around in you know, skimpy clothing? I mean, even kids. I think Britney Spears did the most harm to our young girls with the kind of clothes that have become fashionable. That's not all Britney, but I can't help but think she played a big part in it because she's so popular with that younger crowd. And you know, putting words on the seat of pants, whose idea was that? I was at an RV show. I was in a booth representing the resort that I had some involvement with. And all these girls are walking by. And I go, she's got writing on it. What does that say? And I realize I am looking at the hind end of a 12-year-old little girl. And it was like, my word. No pun intended. But why? Why do we need to have advertisements or even innuendos on the seat of pants? Because it draws your attention to a body part that you shouldn't be paying attention to, especially on these young girls. And the same kind of thing is going on in Judah. Their wanton eyes, their outstretched necks, they're jingling with their feet, they've got their bracelets on. And the Lord said, I will uncover your secret parts. He's referring to Isaiah is referring to here, when the Babylonians come and capture you, it was very common practice that all the captives were stripped naked and marched back to wherever they were going for. And they were exposed. They were exposed not only just physically, but exposed to the elements. And it was very degrading. And it contributed to those captives being in submission. And here's this, I will uncover their secret parts. God is saying, you're going to get captured. You're going to get stripped naked and led back into captivity. And in that day, the Lord will take away the finery. All that bling is going away. Okay? The Lord will take away the jingling anklets, the scarves, and the crescents. And these crescents are probably a moon-shaped ornament that had to do with lunar worship. We find in 2 Kings that the camels had these crescents on them, and that some of the kings of Midian had these crescents that were all part of worshiping the moon. The pendants, the bracelets, the veils, the headdresses, the leg ornaments, the headbands, the perfume boxes, the charms and the rings, the nose jewels. There's them. Nose jewels, your eyebrow piercings, your lip rings, all that stuff. The festal apparel. Festal just means festive. The gay apparel. Festive apparel. And the mantles, the outer garments, the purses and the mirrors, the fine linen, the turbans and the robes. It's all going away. Now, this is stuff they were all wearing. And if we can look over in Ezekiel and find a very similar passage in chapter 16. Chapter 16 of Ezekiel, starting in verse 10. I clothed you in embroidered cloth and gave you sandals of badger skin. I clothed you with fine linen and covered you with silk. I adorned you with ornaments and put bracelets on your wrists as a chain on your neck. I put a jewel in your nose, earrings in your ears, and a beautiful crown on your head. Thus you were adorned with gold and silver, and your clothing was of fine linen, silk, and embroidered cloth. You ate pastry, like from Pindles, of fine flour, honey, and oil. You were exceedingly beautiful and succeeded to royalty. Your fame went out among the nations because of your beauty, for it was perfect through my splendor, which I bestowed upon you. God doesn't want us to be plain. He wants us to be beautiful in his sight. He will adorn us in these things. But when we then use it in a haughty way, and with wanton eyes and mincing steps, and abuse that beauty, that's when we're going to get ourselves into big trouble. Verse 24, and so it shall be, instead of a sweet smell, there will be a stench. Instead of a sash, a rope. Instead of a well-set hair, baldness. Instead of a rich robe, a girding of sackcloth. And branding instead of beauty. So when Ahaz comes, that wicked king Ahaz brings those Babylonians, instead of a sweet smell, there's going to be a stench. Now, if you remember in Esther, the women who would go before the king would spend a year soaking in perfumes and oils and all these nice smelling things, so that they when they went before the king, they would have this pleasant aroma. And it was very common in these days because of just the lifestyle, that you wore a lot of perfumes. It's just like deodorant, you know, a little, I got a secret, right? And instead of that pleasant aroma, there's going to be a stench. Instead of this beautiful sash, it's just going to be a rope. Instead of well-set hair, instead of hours in front of the mirror primping those golden locks and those long tresses, there'll be baldness. Instead of a rich robe, a girding of sackcloth, and branding
instead of beauty. Some versions say burning instead of beauty. Alabaster skin, that white, pale skin, was very, very desirable. That showed how rich you were. You didn't have to work out in the sun. And when all this is stripped away, and you're going to be sunburnt, and this, your skin is going to show that age that comes with suntan after suntan after suntan, and they'll be burning and branding instead of beauty. Your men shall fall by the sword, and you're mighty in the war. And indeed, in 2 Chronicles, we find that Ahaz kills 120,000 men in one day. The men are killed by the sword. Her gates, her being Jerusalem, and her gates shall lament and mourn, and she, being Judah, will be desolate and shall sit upon the ground. Sitting on the ground was a sign of mourning. And the lamenting at the gates, that's where all the business took place. At the gates, that was where you went to make deals and have interactions and talk and chat and carry on. It's like, you know, going to the coffee shop. You know, you go to the gates. And when the gates are full of lamenting and mourning, that's not a good thing. That's not how you want your city. As a matter of fact, there was some Roman coins that were minted well after this whole Babylonian thing portrayed Jerusalem as a woman kneeling in the ground mourning. And it's a posture that represents that. So moving on in chapter 4, and in that day, seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, we will eat our own food and wear our own apparel. Only let us be called by your name to take away our reproach. All the men are gone. And there's too many women. There's not enough men for husbands. And in that day, in the day when all this is coming and the Babylonians have taken everyone away, the women are saying, hey, guys, you know, you don't forget about all our rights as wives. We'll take care of our own food. We'll take care of our own clothes. Just give us your name so we can have children and not be reproached from that, not have children outside of wedlock. I mean, there's desperation there. But in that day, now you know, Cohen talked last week about sometimes you're reading Isaiah's prophecy about what's going to happen, and sometimes you're reading the description of what's going on with Judah. You know, so here we have this first part about all the women looking for a husband. That's the conditions of Judah. And now when we go to in that day, we're talking about after. We're talking about after the tribulation there. In that day, the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful. Who's the branch? Christ Jesus is the branch. So there is still hope. After all of this that's gone on, all this darkness, there's still hope. Looking ahead, he says, in that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and appealing for those of Israel who have escaped, who have survived that tribulation. And it shall come to pass that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy. Everyone who is recorded among the living in Jerusalem, all the people who are still there will recognize that he is holy, that Jerusalem, that Christ is the branch, he's the Redeemer, he is the resurrected Messiah. When the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the blood of Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment, and by the spirit of burning, those are the tools he's going to use, the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning, to cleanse the evil from the world, because the tribulation is over. He's done. He's used that spirit of judgment. He's used that spirit of burning, and he has now purged the blood of Jerusalem from her midst. Then the Lord will create above every dwelling place of Mount Zion and above her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day, a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a covering. It would be just like when the Israelites were led through the wilderness with a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night as a reminder of God's presence, his continual presence, a symbol of what he represents. It will be set up over Mount Zion, over every dwelling place, and there will be a covering. There will be a protection from that. And there will be a tabernacle for shade in the daytime from the heat, for a place of refuge, and for a shelter from storm and rain. That tabernacle is a tent of safety. It's a place where you can go and know that God is going to be there. You can talk to him there. You can ask for forgiveness of your sin in that tabernacle. It will be a shade in the daytime for the heat, a place of refuge, and a shelter from storm and rain in that day. But you have to want that shelter. You have to go in to that shelter. You can know it's there and not get shade. You can know it's there and not have refuge. You must go in. You must go in. And we need to come to a place in our hearts, in our neighborhoods, in our towns, our states, and our country, where we decide that we're going to go in, that we're going to take that refuge, we're going to enter that tabernacle, and we're going to find the shade and the shelter that God has to offer. And until we make that decision to go in, to enter in, we're going to be faced with all these things that Israel is faced with here that Isaiah is predicting. The stench rather than the perfume. The baldness rather than the well-set hair. The mourning and the desolation. But when we enter into that tabernacle, we come in faith and say, God, show me the way to live my life. Show me the way to share my love with my neighbor. Show me the way to take a leadership position in my home. Until we make that step and trust in God, we're going to be outside his will. We're going to be outside of his safety net. And we're going to be wandering and waiting and longing and